Welcome to Sexology, a podcast that untangles the science of sex and pleasure. And now, with this week's episode, your host, clinical psychologist, Dr. Nazanin Moali.
Hello there. Welcome to episode 403 of the Sexology podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Nazanin Moali, and today we have a very interesting episode lined up for you. We're going to interview Dr. Daniel Water. We're going to talk about when your penis is not working. What does it try to communicate with you? Because oftentimes, many people think that if my penis is not working, there is something medically wrong. But we are here to tell you that it's trying to communicate with you. And we're going to teach you how to tune into it and decode what it is trying to say. But before we dive into the episode today, I recently curated this guide specifically for men who want to take charge in the bedroom. One of the challenges that I see with many of my clients, they say that my partner tells me they want me to take charge. They want me to lead them in the bedroom, and I don't know what to do with, or it doesn't go with my personality. And it creates dissatisfaction for many women. They feel not inspired during sex. So I created this quick guide with all the information that you would need in order to take charge in the bedroom. I'm going to exactly tell you why women want to be led. Some of them, of course, people are different, but there are so many women in my practice that they want their partner to take charge specifically in the bedroom. I'm going to tell you what you can do to create the right atmosphere. I'm going to teach you how to take initiative. We're going to talk about seduction, emotional connection, how to do dirty talking. It's a quick guide. It's super affordable. It's like about the cost of a coffee. You can check it in the show notes and you can see if that's a fit for you. But for today's episode, as I mentioned, we're talking about penises and sexual dysfunction, specifically also with sex addiction. Because sometimes people have some issues with what they call sexual addiction, and they try to change it, modify it. They're not seeing results. And as a clinician, I know that sometimes when things are not working, it's not that you're not motivated enough. You are tackling the wrong thing. Our guest today is Dr. Daniel Water. Dr. Water received his doctorate degree from New York University in 1985 and has also earned a postgraduate certificate in medical humanities from Drew University. He's licensed as both psychologist and marital and family therapist. In addition, he is a board-certified sex therapist by American Associate of Sexuality Educator, Counselor, and Therapist, ASAC, and American Board of Sexology, of which is also holds fellow status. Dr. Water is an ASAC-certified sex therapy supervisor and has been elected to fellowship status in the International Society of Study of Women's Sexual Health and Sexual Medicine Society of North America. He has many, many accolades, so I encourage you to check out his full bio in the show notes. He recently published this book, The Existential Importance of the Penis, A Guide to Understanding Male Sexuality. It's one of those books that I've been recommending to many of my clients and clinicians. So if you're a therapist listening to this show, you want to make sure you're checking out this new book. Before we dive into this episode, I just wanted to give a shout out to our sponsor, FirmTech, where health meet pleasure tracks sexual performance and nocturnal erections for vital data on your cardiovascular and sexual health. Understand the effect of medicine and lifestyle. FirmTech has reinvented the cock ring, making it more comfortable and easy to get on and off with its patent hook and loop design. It has a Bluetooth device. It's like a wearable. It's one of the best cock rings in the market. I've been getting, since I started this show, lots of different companies that they produce cock rings. They send a sample for them to be our sponsors. And what I've noticed with other companies, they're just so uncomfortable to wear. I remember with one of their competitors, my husband said, honey, like I need to take this off. This is so painful. But FirmTech, the product it produces, it's so comfortable. You don't feel it. And it helps you with, first of all, tracking your vital data. And second of all, keeping your erection. So make sure that you're checking out their website and use the code Sexology to get 10% off. So head over to myfirmtech.com, use the code Sexology for 10% off, and let me know what you think. I personally love their product. All right, let's dive into today's conversation. Hello and welcome back to another episode of Sexology Podcast. I am so excited to welcome Dr. Daniel Water to our show. Dr. Daniel, welcome to our show.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
I was just sharing with you how excited I was when I read your book. I thought that was a very insightful book, and I can't wait for us to talk about it with my audience. So in the book, you talk about the significance of the penis speaks. It's kind of one of the central pieces is that. Can you tell us what does that mean?
Yeah, sure. You know, I think it's an interesting phrase. I think that a lot of times men's emotions, especially distressing emotions, are often communicated through their penis, especially when they're experiencing relational distress or relational anxiety. You know, the penis for men, especially men having sexual difficulties, is usually sending them a message. It's a message that they don't consciously recognize. It's a message that they often are not able to verbally articulate. And so when they are not able to articulate their emotions, they come out somewhere in the body. And for men, especially in terms of sexual difficulties, the penis sends a message. It usually is a message that is alerting them to some perceived or potential danger or negative consequence. My theory on sexual dysfunction is a little different from what mainstream sex therapy talks about. You know, mainstream sex therapy talks about the importance of performance anxiety as an etiological factor in male sexual dysfunction. I actually don't subscribe to that theory. I think that what happens is that a lot of men who have early childhood trauma, when those traumas get triggered in relationships, they will often experience a message through their penis, which is the way I understand it, it's a self-protective and unconsciously generated one, but it's a self-protective shutdown to stop them from going too deep into the relationship at certain times. So that's kind of what I mean by the penis speaks. You know, men communicate a lot through their penises. There's a slide that many have probably seen. It's one that I will sometimes include in my lectures, which will show, so it's supposed to show the difference between men and women sexually. So the top part is women, and you see myriad graphs and dials and switches and buttons and gauges, and that says women. And then underneath it, it says men, and it's one toggle switch that says on and off. And of course, the toggle switch is in the up or the erect direction. And the message, of course, is women's sexuality is complicated. Men's sexuality is very simple. That really does a disservice to men. It's a funny slide. It always gets some laughs. But I sometimes show it to demonstrate that men are much more emotionally rich than we often believe. Their sexuality is very often complex and nuanced. And the notion that men's sexuality is simple and straightforward is not true. It's just the communication is coming through the penis. The job of the sex therapist working with men is oftentimes to try and help that man understand what message his penis is sending him, what is the issue he needs to work through, and then difficulty usually resolves.
Well, one part of the book that was very intriguing, that you talk about the stories of war veterans and like the disabilities they experience. And you were talking about how one person was not necessarily as concerned about losing his legs, but like losing his penis was very significant. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, you know, I thought that was really a fascinating story. So, You know, I've been working with men with sexual difficulties for over 40 years. And, you know, I just always knew that when men's penises were not working, it wasn't their distress was not just about the fact that they were not able to function sexually. Obviously, that was a part of it. That was, you know, what they often focused on. But for a lot of men, the functioning penis represents something that is really central to their existence, central to their sense of themselves as men, central to their identities. And what really prompted me to write the book was several years ago, I read an article that was in the New York Times about returning veterans who had their penises maimed or disfigured, or they lost them, usually from bomb blasts. And when they came back to the United States and they were interviewed, what they were talking about was how bad they felt about the loss of their genitals, the loss of their penile function. There was one man in particular who was the focus of this article, where he had multiple injuries. He had lost both of his legs. He had lost one arm. And he said, dealing with the loss of my legs was easy. Dealing with the loss of my penis made me suicidal. And many other veterans reported the same kinds of things. I would rather lose the functioning of my arms, my legs. I would rather lose my sight. I would rather lose my hearing. But the loss of the functioning penis was a real existential crisis. And I am an existential psychotherapist. That's the focus of my style of psychotherapy. And a lot of people, you know, ask me, well, you know, what makes something existential? You know, what makes a crisis existential? And basically, existential issues are those issues that threaten our existence. The penis is a life force. It represents aliveness. It represents vitality. It represents a sense of well-being. It means much more than the ability to have sex. That's part of it. And the function of sex is often a life force or a life affirming type of activity. But it really is about much more than sexual function. You know, one of the things, and so, you know, you work with men in sex therapy, you know, so you've seen this, you know, as much as I have, I'm sure. I'm not sure how much, if you wondered about it as much as I do, but look at what men are willing to do to get a functioning penis back, right? They might go for some significant surgery, right? And have a penile prosthesis, a penile implant, very, very complicated surgery. They stick needles into their penises. They use vacuum devices. None of these things are about creating more pleasure, because none of them are pleasant. As a matter of fact, most of them are extraordinarily unpleasant. But the ability to get back a functioning penis is so central to their sense of themselves as men that they will go through all kinds of uncomfortable, painful, expensive processes. You know, even Viagra has side effects, and a lot of men report, you know, they're very uncomfortable. And it's so interesting to me that so many of the men that I've worked with who have been able to get erections through some medical means, you know, injections, implants, whatever it may be, Viagra, when I ask them, so how did that feel? They almost never say pleasure. They say they feel relieved. This is about so much more than just the ability to have sex.
I agree with you. And I think what's interesting is that sometimes people minimize sex. Oh, it's just sex. And colleagues, sometimes they don't ask about people's sexual health. But as you mentioned, that it can be very connected with their people's sense of identity, losses. And it's really important to address those issues, because I have seen people that they have erectile unpredictability challenges and they were suicidal because of it. And their concern wasn't necessarily only the sexual issue. They felt defective. They felt not good enough. So that was kind of like something that impacted their core belief in a way.
Yes.
So as I love that you were talking about the broader concept, right? Kind of people think about anything erection, kind of like penis related, they think more of a medical model, right? They go immediately for testosterone, and then they're going to go to hopefully to their primary care doctor, have medication. But oftentimes people don't think about the psychology behind it. And if you want to think about it, it's easier to think about, I'm going to have the pill and the issue gets resolved versus I'm going to go to this through this process to see what my body's communicating. For our listeners that they are hearing us, how can they kind of like examine, is their penis communicating with them if they have challenges, or it's a medical issue, or it's a combination of things?
Yeah, you know, it can be all of them, right? I mean, there are certainly times when men's penises are compromised for medical reasons. It could be illness related. It could be injury related. It could be medication side effects. Sometimes it could be a combination of something physical and psychological. But, you know, I do think that most men are really curious about why their penis functions the way it does. They typically have no idea, you know, why they have difficulty, when they have difficulty, but they are really curious. And what I have found is that for some men, obviously these medical interventions are satisfying and they are helpful. And, you know, it's great that they're available. But what a lot of people don't realize, and maybe some of the men that are listening, you know, today have experienced this, is that most of these things have very, very high dropout rates. Even Viagra, Viagra and the other oral medications, they're very popular, obviously. I mean, it's a $1 billion industry. But the refill rate is very, very low. Penile injections, vacuum devices. People drop out of these treatments. They don't really get to the core of whatever the issue is. And so I remember speaking with a colleague of mine. This was back in 1998 when Viagra first came onto the market. And we thought, yeah, we're done. You know, we are out of business. You know, this is it. We always worried, you know, if there was a pill that could take care of this, we would all be out of business. And the exact opposite happened. The exact opposite happened. What we actually even got busier and busier. And I believe that the reason that happened is what Viagra did, because it was a non-invasive, fairly easy option, it brought a lot more men into the healthcare system. And once they were in the system, they were more likely to follow through to find out what was at the root of their difficulties. So, you know, even the men who started with Viagra, you know, they tried that maybe for a couple of months, but it either didn't work well for them, or they were not satisfied, or didn't address whatever psychological issue was creating the sexual shutdown in the first place, and they became much more likely to pursue sex therapy. It was a big surprise, a welcome surprise, but it taught me also something very important about men, that men do care about their emotions. They do feel things. And the restoration of erectile ability is not just about getting an erection and being able to have sex. There's something else significant behind it. My thinking, of course, is those are usually very existential issues.
Well, I think it's really important to offer an alternative lens for people that they're kind of curious why these things are not working for us. And even if the medication works, like that's the kind of like experience I have with antidepressant, for example, right? It helps you unless it's strongly physiologically kind of like related. It helps you to get out of that kind of like depth of depression, but you need to learn skills and strategies to change like life circumstances. And I can imagine with Viagra, even with that, that could be something that maybe kind of like give you hope, but like it might not necessarily change the whole dynamic. And I know many people are even scared of having sex or having any sexual initiation when the medication is not around. So that can also impact people's self-confidence. Speaking of emotions, I know in the book you talk about how when the relationship deepens, then people's erectile functioning gets impacted, which I've seen many times in my practice. I've seen it more through attachment lens, but it's fantastic the way that you were talking about it. Can you tell us about the pattern that you see?
Yeah. And it is very much related, I think, to attachment theory. There are some differences, but that is a very good way of understanding it through the lens, you know, that I use. So what I started to notice, and again, this is actually a very good illustration, I think, of this whole existential crisis that presents itself, is that the vast majority of men that I see having erectile difficulties, they usually don't have difficulty getting an erection. Sometimes they do, but oftentimes they do not. They often don't have difficulty maintaining the erection until they get to the point of penetrative sex. And it's usually at the point of penetration or shortly thereafter that the erection fades. So the first question that comes to my mind is, okay, so if you can get an erection and you can keep an erection, what is it about penetration that would create some difficulty? Then what I start to think about is so many of the men, and probably by far the most common pattern I see is men having erectile unpredictability. I like that. I like that term. They have erectile unpredictability with someone that they have had a history of good sex with, and sometimes for a very long time. And all of a sudden they start to have difficulty. And I always wondered, why would that be the case? And so performance anxiety, as I was saying before, is typically what's proffered as the etiological factor here. But why would you have performance anxiety if you have a good history of sexual functioning and you have a good history of sexual functioning with the partner that you are now having difficulty with? Why would you be worried about performance at this time? It makes no sense to me. So I started looking at other factors, and what I noticed was oftentimes if I was able to create a good timeline with the man that I was working with, the erectile difficulties would begin after what I refer to as a relationship deepening event. So what you often hear is, you know, sex was great and then we moved in together. Sex was great and then we got engaged. You know, sex was great and then we got married or made some other kind of commitment. And as the relationship deepened, the vulnerability increases, and that's how the penis sends the message. It's saying, this is getting too deep. This is getting too involved. There is some danger here. And so it self-protectively shuts the penis down. That's why you can get an erection and keep an erection, but there's something about that penetration, that sort of fusing of the bodies that represents the deepening connection. And as the relationship deepens, the vulnerability about that connection deepens. So what kinds of things would create that difficulty? So this is really where a lot of my work here differs from a lot of traditional sex therapy, is my belief is that oftentimes early childhood trauma gets triggered unconsciously, obviously, when a relationship deepens. So in other words, you know, we talk a lot about trauma and sexual and its effect on sexuality when we talk about sexual trauma. And, you know, obviously for many reasons, you know, sexual trauma can interfere with sexual function. But what I often see is the result of non-sexual traumas. People who have been abandoned, rejected, neglected, suffocated, smothered. And what happens is that when the relationship is casual, those things don't feel so threatening to me. As the relationship deepens, I am more vulnerable to the pain of abandonment, rejection, suffocation, neglect, whatever it may be. And my penis is telling me, this feels dangerous. This is risky. This is a threat to our existence. And so it self-protectively disrupts the sexual connection. So to avoid that kind of hurt and pain, you know, obviously it creates problems of its own, which is really why the therapy is so helpful. But I have found that if you can get the man to understand what that increased vulnerability is, what that message his penis is trying to alert him to, and then deal with those concerns, you know, because once they go from unconscious to conscious, you can deal with them. You know, this is actually much more commonly talked about in the trauma literature than the sex therapy literature. I don't know if you are, or your listeners are familiar with the work of Bessel van der Kolk, the psychiatrist, the trauma psychiatrist. You know, his groundbreaking book, you know, the Body Keeps the Score, is really all about this. Trauma resides in the body. And if it's unacknowledged, if it's unexpressed, it's going to come out somewhere else. It's coming out. And so it will come out in some somatic form, some bodily function. And the penis is the perfect conduit when the trauma has been relational. You know, it sits in the body. All of a sudden, the risk feels higher, the vulnerability feels higher, and the penis shuts down to protect the man.
And this kind of way of looking at this issue completely makes sense, because I can imagine there are times that when you are with the first lover, like it's the first time you're having sex, anxiety can intervene with you having kind of experiences.
It can, yeah.
But what I hear often is that people saying that, like, now we're living together, now we got engaged, and now I have erectile unpredictability or even erectile dysfunction. And at times people think about, okay, how did I de-eroticize my partner too quickly? But it sounds like it's a different way, right? Like if that happens so quickly, it is that triggers that comes from deepening of vulnerability and your body wants to protect you from that.
Yes, that I agree. And that's also, you know, what I think about when I think about how emotional men really are. You know, they often don't express it. They're often not very good at articulating it. But that fear and sense of vulnerability is very, very strong in a lot of men, especially men who have had these very difficult childhoods of abandonment and neglect and rejection or over control and suffocation. You know, all those things that would make you feel like getting into a committed relationship is somehow dangerous because it wasn't my childhood. That's the thing. But it's not conscious. It resides in the body.
Okay, let's be real. Who wouldn't want better sex? I mean, like, who wouldn't want to start having better sex right now? The easiest way to get started, just head over to adamandeve.com. They're seriously the best trusted name in adult products. And they're offering an amazing deal just for you. You can get 50% off almost any item when you're using my code SEXOLOGY, SEXOLOGY. And that's not even the best part. You'll also get free discreet shipping and rush processing. Like, they're not messing around. Your package will get there fast and nobody will know what's inside. Whether you're looking for a fun new toy or something else to get things spicy in the bedroom, Adam and Eve's got your back. And it's all just a few clicks away. So go to adamandeve.com. Pick something exciting and use code SEXOLOGY at checkout for 50% off and free shipping with rush processing. Don't miss out. Better sex is literally just a click away.
And kind of like going through therapy, as you mentioned, that it can help people to kind of like uncover some of these unconscious patterns and address that. And I bet it's not only impacting their sexual health, it can impact so many different parts of their lives, as we talked about it. One of the highly debated areas in the world of sexual health is sexual addiction, quote unquote, sexual addiction. Mm-hmm. I know that addiction therapists have their own way of approaching things, sex therapists having a different way of approaching it at times. And the idea is that you have, in a way, this out of control sexual experiences. Like you kind of at times, addiction, people talk about increasing tolerance. You want more and more of something that's like you're building tolerance. I know, again, in sex therapy, people are looking at it in a different way. But about the kind of like onset of these things, the how these patterns start, you have such an interesting way of looking at it in your book. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, sure. That's actually, you know, in many ways, how I got started applying existential psychotherapy to sex therapy was by working with so many men who were experiencing this uncontrollable sexual behavior. you know, and which is, as you said, oftentimes referred to as sexual addiction. You know, that's a big debate in the sex therapy community these days, of course. Is there such a thing as sexual addiction? Can sex be, you know, addictive, et cetera, et cetera? One of the nice things about being an existential psychotherapist is we are completely unconcerned with the diagnostic process. Labeling just gets in the way. I don't care what people call it. People come to me in distress and I attend to the distress. You want to call it sexual addiction. You want to call it out of control sexual behavior. You want to call it sexual compulsion. I don't care. It doesn't really matter to me. So when I first started seeing this, though, I was, you know, like most sex therapists, you know, following the more addiction model. I thought that the work of Patrick Carnes was really insightful and very interesting. But there were times where it just didn't seem to be quite enough. It just didn't seem to quite fit. And of course, one of the problems, I think, with labeling is then you start treating the label, right? So in other words, if you really believe in something like sexual addiction, then you would treat all behavior that looks like that from an addiction model. I kind of look at it the other way around, which is the notion that, okay, this behavior is trying to tell us something. Again, what's the message? What is this about? And it's a different therapy for everybody. It's not I do not subscribe to a protocol-driven therapy or, you know, more of a medical model, which is, you know, this is the illness, this is the treatment. My work in existential therapy is very heavily influenced by the work of Irv Yalom, who some of your listeners may know. He's the most brilliant psychotherapist I have ever met. His work transformed my way of doing therapy, my understanding of people, my own personal life. And so what I started to see in a lot of these men were men coming in who sexual behavior was perfectly controlled for a long time. And then something happened. But traditionally, sex therapy and certainly sex addiction therapy hasn't really looked at it that way. You know, their focus is more on let's curb the behavior, let's control the behavior, let's stop the behavior. Then, you know, I get that. You know, it's certainly logical, but I come more from a standpoint where if you don't understand the behavior, then it's very difficult to control it because, you know, there's always things like symptom substitution. You know, you could shut something down here, but then it's going to come out here. You know, if there's something driving this behavior, then if you don't figure out and attend to that driver, then problematic behavior, it may shift, but it continues. So what I started to notice was that a lot of the men that I worked with, they described their sexual behavior spiraling out of control after a confrontation with mortality. And I have collected now probably 70 or more cases of men whose sexual behavior was perfectly fine, perfectly controlled, never problematic. And then there's a confrontation with mortality and they panic. It's an existential fear of death and they panic. And then they turn to sex as a life force, sex as the antidote to death. So I know for a lot of your listeners that, and for a lot of sex therapists, that seems a little out there, but the connection between sex and death is not discussed very much in the sex therapy literature at all. It's not discussed much in the psychology literature, but if you look at great literature, Hemingway, Dickens, Philip Roth, the old philosophers, they talk about this all the time. And I have many literary examples in my book. I'll just tell you about one to illustrate the point, because I think it was one of the most, just one of the strongest indicators of what I'm talking about. So a lot of people may be familiar with Elie Wiesel's book, Night, you know, where Elie Wiesel, he's written, you know, many books, he's a Holocaust survivor, really dedicated his life to, you know, talking about the Holocaust and teaching about the Holocaust so that, you know, atrocities like that would not happen again. So in his book, Night, he talks about being on the train to Auschwitz. And everybody knows where they're going. And by now, you know, word has filtered back, you know, into, you know, what happens when you get to these camps. People knew that they were on their way to death. And yet on the train, many people were having sex in this crowded train on their way to an extermination camp. People are having sex. Now, there is no way that you can convince me that that was because they thought that this was somehow really erotic. You know, it just isn't the case. It's that a lot of times when death is what you see, sex is what is used to counter the terror of death. So a lot of times what I would see in these men who had these sexual addictions, they would find things like, well, I'll give you some examples, you know, that I include in the book. You know, there was one man who his father died young. And this, by the way, is very often, you know, a feature that you'll see in these men is they have fathers or important people in their lives who died young. So he had a father who died young. His father died, I think it was like 54, something like that. And so a lot of men in particular, women too, but I've seen this more in men. If their fathers die young, they're afraid that they will not live longer than that age. And as they get closer and closer to that age, their anxiety, they notice it increasing. They think about it a lot. This one particular guy, father died at 54, and he says that he remembers that from the time he was 50, he was preoccupied with death. He was afraid that, you know, he wasn't going to make it past 54. That's when his father died. He thought about death a lot more. He found himself just becoming much more anxious. He had lived a monogamous, vanilla kind of life, happily married, the whole thing. So he's 53 years old and he's approaching 54 and he starts to think, okay, I'm going to make it. I'm going to make it. During a routine physical, his doctor feels an abnormality, a lump on his prostate. He goes for a biopsy. The biopsy is positive. He's diagnosed with prostate cancer and he goes off the rails. He starts having sex with everybody he can find. He's out there in bars picking up people, doing risky things, going for the first time to, you know, adult bookstores, to go into the booths and have sex with other men. I mean, all of this uncharacteristic behavior and completely, you know, out of his normal routine. He ended up deciding, you know, I have to leave my wife. He quit his job. He left his wife. He ended up in a hotel someplace down south with a woman that he had picked up on the way during his travels and attempted suicide down there. And his wife went down, brought him back. And that's when he entered therapy with me. All of this precipitated by his prostate cancer diagnosis, which, by the way, was very treatable. But nevertheless, you know, people hear the word cancer, it's so frightening. And his sexual behavior went off the rails. It's an attempt to quell that fear, that panic, that terror of death. So I started to see a lot of men with this same kind of pattern. And one of my most interesting cases, which I also write about in my book, is I was working with this guy who came into therapy because he was about to get divorced for the third time. And the reason he was getting divorced was because his third wife found out that he was having affairs, many affairs. That was the same thing that happened with his first wife and his second. And he said to me, he said, and they have no idea, trust me, how many women I have slept with when I was married. And he said, I need to do something about this because, you know, here I am getting divorced for the third time. I'm very unhappy about that. And I don't understand it because I have loved each of my wives. I thought they were beautiful. Sex with them was terrific. And yet here I am doing all kinds of risky sexual things with other women, including with one of his wives having sex with her sister. He couldn't quite understand. He said, I must have a sexual addiction. So I said to him, and by this time I had seen probably a dozen or so men like this. And so I was probably a little more cavalier you know, than I should have been. And I looked at him and I said, do you know when this began? And he said, you know, I do. I do. It began right after my 33rd birthday. Up until that point, you know, I was not a player in high school or college and the early years of my first marriage. I was not doing any of these things. But right after my 33rd birthday, I started having affairs with everybody. So I said to him, again, too cavalierly, I said, your father died young, didn't he? And he said, yes. How did you know? And I said, oh, just a theory I had. You know, how old was he when he died? Fully expecting him to say 33. And he said he was 62. And I guess I looked disappointed or surprised or something like that. Because he said to me, he said, oh, you look, you know, like that's not the answer you were looking for, or something like that. And then I explained to him my theory, you know, that a lot of times, you know, as men approach the age that their fathers died, that's when their sexual behavior goes out of control. And he said, oh, no, no, no. He said, I'm quite certain it happened right after my 33rd birthday, and my father died at 62. Okay, so let's keep talking. Let's see what we can figure out. And so we're talking for a few more minutes, and all of a sudden, he just stops. He just stops talking. And he says, oh my God, I just remembered. My father died of a heart attack at age 62, but that was his third heart attack. He had his first heart attack at 33. It's a fascinating concept. And it's not always the fathers, but oftentimes it is. You know, I don't know if you've ever heard of the folk singer Loudon Wainwright III, but Loudon Wainwright III was, or is, you know, he's really a very, very talented musician and songwriter. And his father also died young. And he worried his whole life that he would die young early, like his father did. And when he passed the age that his father died, he had this explosion of creativity and music. And he has an entire album called Older Than My Old Man Now, which is all about his experiences, his emotional experiences from passing the age that his father died. It's a fascinating construct. But there are others too. You know, there are men that I have worked with who have had peers die that with emotion, a sexual spiral for them. I've seen that many times. You know, when death comes early, it always feels like it's close. You know, when it comes early, when it comes to your peers, it always feels like that could be me. And that terror of death very often results in a sexual explosion. Again, another way that men's emotionality is expressed through what their penises do. You know, I don't know that it would necessarily, you know, fall into the sexual addiction type of behavior. But when you know, you first contacted me about doing this, you know, one of the chapters that, you know, you said you were very interested in is the one on, you know, why men behave badly. And, you know, the narrative, of course, is that, well, men are just greedy, power hungry, domineering, they have to be oppressive, you know, all of this stuff. And that does happen sometimes. That does happen sometimes, of course. But if you look at people like Tiger Woods, Elliot Spitzer, Matt Lauer, Anthony Weiner, Louis C.K., all of them had early death experiences that were probably, in my opinion, I wouldn't be surprised. I don't know any of these men. I didn't work with any of these men, but I did research their histories. They all either had early death experiences or recent death experiences that precipitated their sexual slide. None of them had reputations for being players like that and doing the kinds of high-risk things that they did. You know, in New York, of course, you know, which is the area that I'm from, you know, we're always, of course, very interested in the fall of Anthony Weiner and Elliot Spitzer, prominent men with great reputations, great careers. Yet, why did they take such chances? Sexually, right? It's always sexually. Why do men do these things sexually? And very often, it's because there is some triggering of an early death trauma that they are trying to quell. And I don't think that that has been recognized nearly enough. You know, the idea that it just, you know, men are just, they need to assert their power. I'm not saying that that's never the case, but oftentimes That's not the case. They are dealing with their own triggered traumas.
Well, Dr. Daniel, as I was revealing the book for our conversation, there was just so many different pieces that I wanted to talk about. And I bet our listeners are very intrigued. I know that your book is psychologically stimulating, but it has such a beautiful narrative as well. It's very engaging. So for our audience that they are interested to get the book, what are some of the places they can access it?
Yeah. So thank you. The title of the book is The Existential Importance of the Penis, A Guide to Understanding Male Sexuality. And it's published by Routledge. So you can certainly buy it from the Routledge site. But probably what's easiest and where the price is the best for people who would like to read it, you can go right to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or, you know, any of the online booksellers. It's easily available. And you know, even though it is a theoretical book in many ways, and I initially wrote it with sex therapists in mind, I tried to make it, you know, a very readable and interesting kind of book. I tried to make it the kind of book that I like. I'm not a big statistics person, a research person. I mean, obviously that is important, but I like to use more illustrations to make my point. So there are a lot of case studies in the book and a lot of references to literature. You know, I am just a big, big fan of great literature. And I think there's so much psychological richness, you know, in, as I was saying before, you know, the work of Hemingway and Philip Roth and Tolstoy and Dickens. And, you know, I just think they have so much psychological insight that I would use excerpts of their work to illustrate some of my points in terms of men and sexuality. Also movies, you know, there's some very interesting, you know, films, you know, there's some of your listeners may be familiar with Moonstruck, you know, which was, you know, a big movie back in the 80s, I guess. Maybe it was the 90s, but I think it was the 80s. And it starred Cher and Olympia Dukakis and really a great, great cast, Nicolas Cage. And there's a scene in there where Olympia Dukakis finds out that her husband has been having affairs. And she corners Danny Aiello, who plays Cher's boyfriend. And she says to him, why would a man need more than one woman? I don't understand. Why would a man need more than one woman? And Danny Aiello says, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe because he fears death. And Olympia Dukakis says, yes, yes, that's it. That's it. Exactly. And there's a scene, a couple of scenes later, where her husband is leaving the house. And she says, where are you going? And he says, I've got some errands to run. She says, yeah, well, you're going to die anyway. So even there, you know, there's this recognition of, you know, the use of sex and as a hedge against mortality. Anyway, I tried to write it in such a way where I would incorporate a lot of those things. So, you know, hopefully some of your listeners who may not be therapists or may not be, you know, researchers still might find the book, you know, to be an interesting read. I hope so.
Well, many of our listeners are professionals and they're kind of interested in the similar kind of book. And I leave a link in the show notes to the book. Again, thank you so much for your time. This was a fantastic opportunity to learn about all of these things, and hopefully we'll have you on our show in future.
Well, thank you. I would love to come back and be on the show. Thank you very much.
I hope you guys enjoyed our conversation. As a clinician, one of the misconceptions that I often see that really impacts people sexual functioning is when they label themselves as sex addict. I have extensive training on sex addiction because that's how first I got into the field of sexual health. But then later on, what I realized is that this model is not serving people. So if you have a sexual behavior that's not working for you, I'm not saying that, oh, you have to accept that or you must embrace it. You get to have goals for your sexuality and sexual health, but if that is a case for you, maybe you want to go to a certified sex therapist, someone that they have the right tools to help you to reach your goals. Because sometimes I find people thinking about, I'm a sex addict, and then they continue with a path that's not effective, it's not evidence-based, and then they quote-unquote relapse and it's really impact their self-confidence. So if you're interested, you can definitely check out our website. That's something I can help you with. Or let me know if you're in other states and you need support. I can introduce my other colleagues that are sexuality experts and certified sex therapists. Before we close this episode, I want to thank our sponsor again, FirmTech. As I mentioned, if you want to have a more reliable erection or you want to gather information about your penis health, because what it does is it tracks data with blood flow and all the information that you have. So it almost serves as a mini lab. Make sure that you are going to our sponsor's page, myfirmtech.com. Put down the code SEXOLOGY to get 10% off. All right. I hope I'll see you guys next week right here. And if you got FirmTech, let me know. Their product is amazing, but I'm always curious to hear your thoughts on it. All right. Chat soon.
Thanks for listening to the SEXOLOGY podcast. For more great content, visit www.sexologypodcast.com. Please be advised that information presented on this podcast is not a substitute for seeking help from a licensed mental health provider.